Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the March 2025 issue. I'll begin with New World Symphonies, Listening for the Future of Music, by Matthew Sherrill. Jean-Francois Laporte stood on the stage of a Georgia Tech auditorium, manning the helm of what could have been a device of extraterrestrial origin. What looked to be a keyboard stand had been outfitted with an audience-facing drum head at either end, between which lay a hopelessly tangled nest of tubes, knobs, and cables. In the center of the contraption, a PVC pipe hung down and curled under itself like a great proboscis. Jean-Francois, a bald, 55-year-old Quebecois, in a slim-fitting black t-shirt and Coke bottle glasses, was perched imposingly above it all, looking not unlike a futuristic aviator piloting a giant cybernetic wasp. Gravely serious, Jean-Francois began flicking at the taut latex drumheads, pulling at valves and tweaking dials. The machine responded with a series of chirps and squeaks, then a sequence of electronic pops, some anguished ululations, the squeal of a deflating balloon, and finally, a low-register woodwind hum. After a few noisy minutes, everything fell silent. The performance was over. The handful of people scattered throughout the auditorium offered applause. A few nodded and scribbled notes. The Babel Table, as he'd named it, was one of 10 finalists in the 2024 Guthman Musical Instrument Competition, an annual event held to identify and promote the newest and greatest ideas in music. The Babel Table's competitors, scattered around the stage, consisted of a number of other newly designed instruments, only a few of which, to the amateur's eye at least, were recognizable as instruments in the first place, their appearances ranging from a small, unassuming wooden box to what could have been mistaken for a military-grade rocket launcher. Judging the Guthman were three former contenders. Bosco Conte, a Grammy Award-winning musician featured on Earworms by Dua Lipa, Kanye West, and Big Boy. Kelly Snook, an ex-NASA scientist turned something called data sonification researcher, and Andrew McPherson, the head of the venerable-sounding Augmented Instruments Laboratory at Imperial College London. All three were Guthman royalty, having been conferred prizes in previous competitions. Conte for his electro-spit talkbox, about which no less luminary than T-Pain himself concluded, "This is fucking cool." Snook for her Mimu gloves, employed most notably by the two-time Grammy winner Imogen Heap. And McPherson for his magnetic resonator piano, seemingly just a cool contrivance with neither commercial potential nor a pop star endorsement. This trio would hear live demos, fiddle with the instruments, and interrogate their inventors before declaring a winner. For the grand finale, contestants would be paired with local musicians and given a few hours to plan, or plan to improvise, a brief performance for whatever audience existed in Atlanta for this sort of thing. Georgia Tech branded it the Jam Session of the Future. Jean-Francois has a distinguished resume for an avant-garde composer, earning accolades across the Great White North. He grew up in Montreal, aspiring to be a house builder, but then lucked into an exchange program and traveled to Kinshasa in what was then Zaire, a land he thought of as the capital of music in Africa. He returned to Canada several months later with a reinvigorated sense of creative possibility and the idea that his skill as a builder, with material passing through my hands, might help him construct a music career. In 1997, he released Mantra, his most renowned and most Canadian composition, a 20-odd-minute recording of a compressor cooling a hockey rink. I dug it up on YouTube and found it reminiscent of listening to Breaking Waves on an old CB radio. Dusted Magazine called it a deeply moving piece of mechanical mysticism, like a lawnmower on acid. It's kind of a classic, he told me. The Babble Table was a defiantly acoustic instrument, generating its sound through the manipulation of compressed air. Given Jean-Francois' training as a civil engineer and builder, the instrument's mechanics made a certain amount of sense. I imagined it as a kind of sonically resonant HVAC system. It was originally made for a stage show devised to teach children about marine life, and Jean-Francois had bestowed lighthearted nicknames on the Babble Table's various sounds and controls. The chirps were the product of his insects, tiny metal pipes covered with latex membranes. The agitated ululations stemmed from a different vibrating membrane that Jean-Francois called the Diva. When the entire machine was brought into service, it sounded sometimes like the din of heavy machinery, sometimes like a chorus of jungle fauna. It's no insult to Jean-Francois's ingenuity to admit that it was difficult to imagine the Babble Table as the harbinger of a new oral reality, forging a bold, uncharted path into the musical hinterlands, or really, to imagine it doing much beyond soundtracking a lesson for schoolchildren about jellyfish or phytoplankton. But that's an almost impossible standard, to be fair. How many genuinely new instruments over the past century, over the past two centuries, have attained an enduring place in musical culture anyway, let alone popular musical culture, which, to my mind at any rate, has struggled to evolve much at all over the past few decades? And at a moment when more or less any sound, any effect, is already at our digital fingertips, doesn't the likelihood that any particular new instrument might hold the key to our musical future grow vanishingly small? In such a world, who needs new instruments? To dub the Guthman, the jam session of the future was, in this sense, almost laughably quixotic. And yet, the promise that I might descry that future, that I might, decades from now, be able to smugly and persistently remind my children that I was there the night the now ubiquitous Babble Table was first introduced to the public's collective ear was difficult to resist. If this was indeed the jam session of the future, I wanted to be there for the jamming. In 1841, Adolf Sax brought a newly invented instrument to the Brussels Industrial Exhibition. By then, the prolific Belgian tinkerer had already made a lasting contribution to the history of musical tech with his fundamental revision of the bass clarinet. Compared with this instrument, remarked the conductor François-Antoine Habeneck, the old clarinet is a monstrosity. Sax was also working on a whole suite of sax horns, the 19th century ancestors of modern-day flugelhorns and euphoniums. But despite it all, Sax had grown bitter that he had as yet been unable to place first at any of the previous exhibitions he had attended. He was hoping that this would finally be his breakthrough. Unfortunately for Sax, when he carelessly left his instrument unattended, a still unidentified rival is suspected of kicking it angrily across the room, mangling it so badly that Sax was forced to withdraw it from competition. This, according to not completely unfounded historical conjecture, was the first saxophone. Along with the sousaphone and the steel drum, the saxophone is one of only a few acoustic instruments invented over the past two centuries to have enjoyed any sort of broad popularity, at least in Western music. The sax, importantly, still lacks an official role in the standard symphony orchestra. Subsequent innovations, of course, have largely been of the electronic variety. Chief among them have been the electric guitar and the synthesizer, innovations that, whatever their monumental impact, are nevertheless what are known as augmented instruments, technical modifications of recognizable traditional predecessors. Footnote 1 now appears in the article. It reads, "The question of whether an augmented design constitutes a new instrument is an old one. For most of Sax's career, he was dogged by accusations that his instruments were little more than variations on others. His patents were so violently contested that he wound up being the target of multiple assassination attempts, one of which was averted only after a poorly engineered bomb planted beneath his bed detonated before Sachs happened to call it a night. Now I'll continue with the body of the article. Other recent arrivals, like the sampler or the drum machine, have been more radically disruptive, dispensing with inherited notions of performance entirely and transforming the act of playing into something more akin to coding. McPherson, the professor from Imperial College London, suggested that some of the most significant instruments of our era might be things we wouldn't typically conceive of as such. The digital audio workstation, think Ableton, Pro Tools, or even the modern recording studio. All of which is to say that, with the nature of instruments having grown so abstract, and our available sonic palette having expanded so broadly as to be functionally infinite, the wholesale invention of an instrument has become an increasingly tricky business, if not a totally anachronistic seeming one. And yet the Guthman has been going strong since 2009, when what was formerly a fusty piano competition endowed by the Georgia Tech alumnus Richard Guthman transformed into a showcase for instrument inventors in a bid to tie the school's music program to its international high-tech reputation. New instruments, the organizers decided, would be judged according to three criteria by which entries are still evaluated. First, musicality. How creatively do the gestures involved in playing the instrument relate to the sound? How rich is the sound itself? Second, design. How elegant does the instrument look? And lastly, engineering. How well and how cleverly is the instrument constructed? A chief motivating idea behind the competition was that newly conceived instruments need a live audience if they are to break through to popular consciousness. Jason Freeman, the former chair of Georgia Tech's music school and one of the original forces behind the Guthman's overhaul, recalled the example of Robert Moog, whose pioneering synthesizer had been used in studio settings for years before a version of his invention first appeared on stage. It wasn't until audiences saw it being played with their own eyes that his synth took off commercially. Freeman sees many new instruments as being trapped in Moog-like stasis. The Guthman offers them a chance to break free. In the years since its revamp, the Guthman has attracted an impressive roster of judges, from the 70s downtown doyen Laurie Anderson to the cerebral turntapeless DJ Spooky and the magnificently coiffed jazz fusion guitar god Pat Metheny. Here is footnote number 2. Metheny himself has dabbled in the world of instrument invention, commissioning the renowned Canadian luthier Linda Manzer in 1984 to build him a guitar with as many strings as possible. The result, the 42-stringed Picasso guitar, features two stubby supernumerary necks and looks, needless to say, insane. Now, continuing with the text of the article, the names of past winners and finalists, on the other hand, are a bit less familiar, at least to anyone lacking a comprehensive knowledge of the more obscure corners of contemporary musical arcana. A short but exemplary list, Keith Baxter, an engineer and patent lawyer who took first place in 2023 for his Zen Flute, an MIDI controller whose pitch is manipulated by the shape of the performer's mouth and which Baxter likens to a mouth theremin. Ulfur Hansen, the Icelandic inventor of the 2021 winner, the Segulharpa, a wooden disc-shaped electromagnetic harp that resembles a Viking shield and is played by means of touch sensors embedded in the wood itself. Suprahag Singh, a musician who in 2017 won with the Infinite One, a saxophone-like woodwind capable of playing microtones by use of a set of trombone-like slides. He has since debuted a set of helpful synthesizer plugins to mimic the instrument. Its website claims that it offers a wormhole to music light years ahead. Daniel Vaksi and Topias Terepesi, a pair of Hungarian inventors whose glissitar, a whirlwind operated by magnetized ribbon rather than keys or holes, thus allowing for uninterrupted glissando, took home first prize in 2022 and now retails for about $3,000 via Saxophones Ltd. Leon Gruenbaum, an experimental New York-based composer who was awarded third place in 2011 for the Samchilian Tip-Tip-Tip-Cheese-Pee, a modified ergonomic keyboard whose keys correspond to musical intervals rather than tones. In the years since, Gruenbaum has used the Samchilian in a variety of musical projects, one of which was described by the late great critic Greg Tate as stochastically crunk. To be clear, I love this stuff, but even the most dedicated, socially maladjusted, experimental music fanatic would be forgiven for lacking familiarity with these instruments. Neither does it seem a stretch to say that none of them have meaningfully altered the trajectory of modern music, and yet the Guthman has produced some undeniable mainstream successes of a sort. The OP1 synthesizer, a 2014 Guthman finalist, has been used by Tom York, Diplo, and Animal Collective, while Ryan Gosling can be seen wailing mercilessly on the Seaport Grand keyboard, a descendant of another finalist in the film La La Land. Here is footnote number 3. Gosling's turn as synth whiz, he took 3 months of piano lessons, prompted a surprising amount of media attention, and not just for his apparent chops. A characteristic headline from Time, "That weird keyboard from La La Land is real, and it's a hit." And back to the text. Even the Samchilian Tip-Tip-Tip-Chee-Pee has had a brush with modest fame, having been featured on 3 solo albums by the living color guitarist Vernon Reed. But many of these past victorious instruments, while often exceedingly clever or even awe-inspiring from a technical standpoint, were nevertheless based firmly in established traditions of instrument engineering. The origins of the basic keyboard many of them riffed on lie with the hydraulis, or Greek water organ of the 3rd century BC, and is thought to have assumed its modern 7 white keys, 5 black keys form in 1361. The 6-string guitar, another popular template for Guthman entrants, dates to 1779. Much of the augmented variety, less of the ex nihilo nu. So, while winning the Guthman might garner a bit of press, even the kind that could result in a big screen Gosling adjacent appearance, no small deal to be sure, the variations on keyboards or guitars that tend to dominate the Guthman don't seem likely to herald a wholesale musical sea change anytime soon. Aspiring young musicians aren't exactly lining up to take infinitone lessons, as far as I know, and I didn't happen to notice any Seagull Harpi the last time I wandered into a guitar center. But this didn't necessarily mean that I wouldn't behold some kind of complete upending of the musical world as we know it. After all, who could have foreseen the coming of the Saxhorns? On Friday, the opening day of the competition, the inventors had set up shop on stage at the First Center for the Arts, in preparation for their demos and subsequent critical interrogations. It turned out that Jean-Francois, who had been assigned a slot in the far right corner, was something of an outlier as the only acoustic entrant. Among his electronic competitors was Thomas, a foppish, rail-thin 20-something with a penchant for provocatively unbuttoned silk shirts, and who spoke nonchalantly about Gaussian functions, Faraday's law of induction, and something called the hysteresis curve. His entry, the Lawrence violin, which resembled a compound hunting bow, was effectively a reimagined Hammond organ, producing sound with a series of rotating gear-shaped tone wheels. It was a brilliant device, but one that had difficulty swiftly or cleanly navigating between discrete notes. "It does its best to get there on time," Thomas said, "but sometimes it misses." Standing nearby was Max Adai, a flat-topped Oberlin and MIT grad from New York, who was exhibiting his vocal cords, three parallel rubber strings stretched across a wooden frame. He likened it to a game of cat's cradle. Each string governed a particular sonic attribute as one sang. There was a harmonic string, a rhythmic string, and a timbral string. A singer could modulate his voice by stretching or pulling on individual or multiple strings during a performance. "The singing voice," Max observed, "is one of few musical instruments that typically does not involve touch-mediated interaction." At the center of the stage was Kad Mustatia, a self-described transmedia playwright who was exhibiting the body mouth, a series of sensors strapped to the extremities of two dancers that would produce distinct phonemes according to the dancers' positions in a kind of acoustically rendered game of Twister. Through precisely controlled movements, the dancers would, Kat explained, be able to speak to the audience, though the tech didn't seem to have achieved full fluency. Kat's demo consisted of her speaking words into a microphone, with the dancers positioning their bodies in such a way as to attempt to replicate those words. "Alone," Kat intoned. The dancers contorted themselves accordingly. "Oh, yin, oh." The entrant with the glitziest PR was, without a doubt, Anthony Dickens, a charming industrial designer from Somerset, England. "The first time I tried to connect with him over Zoom, our connection was lousy on account of his wandering around what seemed to be a sheep pasture." Before the competition was underway, he had already extensively promoted his offering, the Circle Guitar. Its website and social media pages boasted slick designs and a glowing testimonial from Ed O'Brien, the lesser known of Radiohead's two guitarists. "Occasionally you see or get to play something that makes you think in a totally different way," O'Brien is quoted as saying. "This is an extraordinary new guitar, and I've already put an order in to buy the first one." The Circle Guitar's gimmick was a rotating wheel embedded in its body and furnished with 16 removable magnetic plectrums, programmable to run at any speed between 30 and 250 RPM. It was, in a sense, the augmented instrument par excellence, designed in pursuit of what Anthony called, not unevocatively, the never-ending strum. He had an enviable, grandiose sense of the instrument's future. He described his vision to me as rock gods running around stadiums. "The Circle Guitar," he said, in a phrase I couldn't quite grasp, but nevertheless admired, aspired to the status of a hyper-instrument. A few of the other contestants came bearing inventions that, while perfectly fun, seemed unlikely to win. A Spanish composer named Santi Villanova had flown over with the Sonograph, a 12 by 8 inch screen on which a performer could doodle with a pen or place found objects. The resulting patterns, providing a kind of alternative musical notation, would then be transformed into sound in real time, a process Santi called image sonification. It had been developed for elementary school musical curricula in Spain, for which it seemed well-suited. Perhaps the greatest long shot was the bone conductive instrument, a wooden polyhedron designed to be held snugly to the breast with the side of one's face resting atop it, almost like an infant. Birdie, as its inventor, Pippa Kelmanson, was fond of calling it, was controlled by sliding analog sensors along two vertical tracks. The novelty of the project was that its sonic frequencies could be felt through the musician's jaw as they played. Hearing through the skull, more or less, rather than the outer ear, in a phenomenon known as, well, bone conduction. Birdie was pitched principally toward the hearing-impaired community, so while its ambition to accessibility was admittedly pretty laudable, the whole thing did feel a bit niche. Even putting aside the fact that Birdie suffered from persistent mechanical malfunctions to the degree that almost every time I saw Pippa over the course of the competition, she was bent over a half-disassembled Birdie, desperately engaged in some form of life-saving voltaic surgery. The winning entrant, I suspected, would at the very least need to work. One of the more surprising aspects of the Guthman was that only a single instrument relied on any form of artificial intelligence. This was Thales, the invention of a bubbly Italian named Nicola Privato. Thales consisted of what resembled two hockey pucks, each containing a magnetometer and a series of magnets, and which produce sonic outputs principally through the interaction of their magnetic fields. In a neat twist, Thales can also respond to any other magnetic field or object that happens to be around. At the Guthman, Nicola demonstrated this with a fiberboard tablet into which he had installed more magnets and onto which he had inscribed what he explained to me was an ancient Icelandic spell. At first, it was somewhat difficult to discern what AI had to do with this at all. Thales, Nicola patiently explained, operates via a particular species of generative AI called neural audio synthesis, which produces fresh sounds based on whatever data set it happens to be trained on. In this particular case, Nicola had used recordings of magnets being thrown against each other, as well as some choral music. What this means in practice is that someone playing Thales and using a data set for the first time will have no idea what sounds they'll be producing or how their use of the controllers will affect those sounds until they're in the very act of performing. The instrument has to be relearned more or less each time the model is trained on a new data set. Nicola likened this process to baking a cake for the first time. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong, but you need to taste it afterward to figure out if it actually worked. This use of AI bore little resemblance to the boogeyman scraping copyrighted material for the raw data necessary to generate new tricks with simple textual inputs and to spit out something that, while often clumsy and uncanny, is quite recognizably and plausibly a song, thus threatening to put a generation of songwriters permanently out of business. On the first day of the competition, Bosco Conte and I loaded up an app called Sumo and, with only a few simple keywords, managed to produce a toe-tapping jazz number whose scatting vocalist sang Guthman's praises with only a few stray lyrical hiccups. Competition's fierce, talent's in the air. Guthman's the place where magic fills the square. It's not bad, acknowledged Bosco. No one at the Guthman could muster much enthusiasm about the Sumos of the world and the economic model they represented, but there was plenty of excitement for other, stranger ways in which AI might be put to musical use. Gil Weinberg, a Georgia Tech professor who helped found the modern Guthman, has been leveraging AI in his work for decades. Back in 2005, he invented Hyle, an anthropomorphic robot drummer capable of listening to music in real time and playing an accompanying beat. More recently, he has been refining Shimon, an improvising robot that sings, dances, and plays marimba with human partners. By engineering robots capable of collaborating, so to speak, with human players, Gil is less interested in making them sound like humans than in leveraging both the sophisticated algorithms with which his robots listen to their human partners and their uncontested mechanical abilities. Shimon has four arms to create music that is different in kind from anything one might produce without high-tech aid. Gil described his robotic ambitions thusly: listen like a human, play like a machine. You are listening to New World Symphonies, Listening for the Future of Music by Matthew Sherrill from the March 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thales, which I had pronounced earlier as Thales, Nicola's more modest AI-powered creation, was what is sometimes known as a composed instrument, one whose sound production is independent from the gestures involved in playing it. Thales, for instance, doesn't transmit discrete audio signals, but rather data that can take on a virtually infinite number of sonic shapes. This severing might explain why I heard so many Guthman candidates describe their creations as controllers or interfaces. Case in point was Yuan, a data-driven instrument that was the invention of Qi Wang, a professor of music at Indiana University. Yuan was a set of several modified tambourines tricked out with motion and temperature sensors so as to respond to any number of different inputs. Watching Qi perform, tracing wide arcs with the tambourines or manipulating them on a pulley system she had devised, I had difficulty fully distinguishing her act from choreography or some kind of interpretive dance. The sound, it seemed, was subservient to the act of making it. The principle behind XEKI, Experimental Expressive Keyboard Instrument, the creation of a three-man team from New York University, was not dissimilar, resembling something between a guitar and a trumpet. Diki was designed to be hoisted on one shoulder and controlled by a series of keys, a movable grip, and the particular orientation of the Ziki in space, each of which modulated a different sonic parameter. Humans are multimodal, the aptly named Orpheus Klifanakos of the Ziki team told me. Orpheus was an unmistakable presence at the Guthman, sporting a head of hair that can only be described as Methaniesque. We want to not only hear sound, he explained, we want to see it. Nor can these two things be neatly decoupled. So experimenting with the expressivity of instruments, the very motions and actions by which they produce sound is, for Orpheus, a way of generating fundamentally new species of music, even if the song remains the same. On Saturday morning, the contestants were sequestered for rehearsal with their assigned accompanists in buildings that otherwise house the University Center for Relativistic Astrophysics, the Phototonics Research Group, and the Office of Radiological Safety. The challenges in figuring out just how to properly accompany an instrument that no one has yet accompanied were myriad. Santi was at pains to make the sonograph's unique form of shape-based musical notation legible to the clarinetist he would be performing with. "I'll be starting with some stars," he explained, not entirely helpfully. Max struggled to find a way to prevent his ethereal vocal cords from being overwhelmed by the performance of his assigned vibraphonist, and Nicola was trying to make sure that the sounds produced by his percussion partner, by means of microtonal bowls, some magnetic spheres, and a ring of keys, were sufficiently creepy. Other contestants faced a mismatch in genre. Anthony and his circle guitar were paired with Milk and Sizz, a Grammy-winning Atlanta production duo. Their idea was to pair the circle guitar's chordal drone with a club-ready track of their own devising, which, I feared, might risk complicating Anthony's guitar god dream somewhat. Nevertheless, this didn't seem to bother Anthony, who relished the prospect of a club-style drop, whereupon the circle guitar's full and literally revolutionary potential would be unleashed on the world in one singular, epiphanic moment. Because we're young and beautiful, champagne flights, we're living in the moment. Then there were the technical problems. The Lawrence violin was still plagued by inconsistent intonation. One of Max's three vocal cords had to be replaced after having snapped during its demo the previous day, and Bertie's temperamental battery was acting up again, though you wouldn't know any of this from the backstage atmosphere of unrelenting camaraderie and mutual encouragement. Contestants spoke enthusiastically with one another about latent space and other concepts more suggestive of a computer science conference than a musical competition. The atmosphere was what I suspect chess camp must feel like, the happy sense that one is meeting future open pals. Nicola to Max, this is so close to being played at gigs. Is it on GitHub? Cat to Nicola, would you be down to jam? Pippa to Santi, I didn't know there were people like us in Spain. The auditorium that night, though only two-thirds full for the evening's performances, seemed equally enthusiastic. A well-dressed man seated near me, who said that he played many instruments, but mainly guitar and flute, asked me to take several photos of him in front of the stage, which he then set about furiously texting out to his friends. In the aisle to my right, a young man, who I gathered was a member of the esteemed Guthman clan, gushed enthusiastically about the press presence, by which he undoubtedly meant the CBS news crew on hand, for whose benefit my own schedule had been constantly and annoyingly tweaked over the course of the weekend. Eventually, Angel Cabrera, the president of Georgia Tech, took the stage for some opening remarks. I had spoken to him earlier in the day and had listened to him both ruminate on the innate human need for musical expression and, somewhat less poetically, compare the Guthman to the television program Shark Tank. How many times have you watched Star Wars? He asked the crowd. This year's competition, he promised, is going to put the Star Wars canteen to shame. Here I'll read footnote number 4. Various nerds are fond of pointing out that John Williams was purposefully ripping off Benny Goodman when he wrote Episode 4's famed Cantina music. The fact that the songs have an obvious earthly predecessor, along with the fact that George Lucas and company could think of no more creative or less gross term to describe this genre in universe than jizz, speaks to certain difficulties in imagining otherworldly music. The crew of the Starship Enterprise, after all, still listens to Chopin's nocturnes, despite there being 400 years of presumptive musical history between 19th century Paris and the age of interstellar travel. Now back to the body of the article. After a few more remarks, Cabrera headed off stage, the lights dimmed, and the showcase began. Things, for the most part, went beautifully. The babble table was fittingly paired with a bassoonist who had tricked out her own instrument with a number of effects pedals and seemed to share an instinctive musical language with Jean-Francois, and Nicola succeeded in manifesting full-on haunted cathedral vibes with Thales. Santi and his clarinetist partner had apparently agreed on what a star signified, and he deftly deployed a number of twigs and leaves, as well as a cigarette lighter, on the sonograph screen to the audience's great delight. For his efforts, Santi would earn the People's Choice Award. Max channeled his inner Arthur Russell and delivered a genuinely lovely, reverb-drenched aria with the aid of his vocal cords, and the body-mouth dancers crept asymptotically closer to the borders of intelligibility. The show was not without its missteps. Unsurprisingly, the circle guitar didn't quite sync properly with Milk plus Sis's party track, and the much-anticipated drop landed with a less-than-earth-shattering impact, though in keeping with the song's theme of living in the moment, no one seemed to mind. Nor did anyone seem to care that the Lorenz violin never did quite manage to stay in tune with its piano partner, producing, if only accidentally, a quivering, hesitant aspect that I found sort of moving. The bone conductive instrument, though, simply failed to work, and Pippa had to retreat backstage for emergency repairs. Bertie's battery died, she later explained. The show had to go on, but in the end, Pippa reemerged, a revived Bertie in her hands, and delivered a performance that, if somewhat musically underwhelming, could not have been more impeccably timed and dramatically satisfying. Soon after, a member of the Guthman family came on stage to deliver the judge's verdict. Third place would go to Nicholas Thales, second to Jean-Francois Babbletable, and first, deservedly as far as I was concerned, to Max's vocal cords. Everyone applauded, everyone seemed happy, everyone seemed to feel that musical justice had been served, if not quite that we had gazed collectively into an infallible crystal ball. It turned out that the jam session of the future differed more in appearance than in sound. The content had been overtaken by the form. Performance preceded essence. Instruments had given way to controllers, interfaces. Augmentation was the default position. There was something that felt a little sad about this state of affairs, maybe, but there was also something invigorating in its orientation toward live experience. It was as if, in introducing the new modes of performance their instrument enabled, the competitors were actually validating a much older one. To watch Max delicately handle the vocal cords, or to see Orpheus raise the ziki triumphantly to the ceiling as it crescendoed, was to be reminded, in ways that were alternatingly a little ridiculous and profound, of the singular power of the stage. Even if none of the entrants was destined to be the next Robert Moog, I could certainly see why Freeman had earlier brought up his example. He must have known, long before I did, that listening to the future of music unfold might not be half as interesting as watching it. Matthew Sherrill is a deputy editor of Harper's Magazine. Now I'll be reading an essay titled Something on Me by Rachel Cusk, from the introduction to a reissue of Martin Amis' novel, London Fields, which was published in November by Vintage in Britain. The curse of Englishness is something whose magnitude we are still taking the measure of in our time. The English habit of not finding others as real as themselves forms a substantial part of this curse. It has fallen on numerous English writers. It fell heavily on Martin Amis. Many of these writers were perhaps not aware that it was a curse, for it surprisingly, often and for long periods, wore the guise of a gift. But Amis was aware of it. Amis' father, the novelist Kingsley Amis, was one of the 20th century's great chroniclers of his fellow countrymen. Kingsley Amis was gloriously witty, drunken, bigoted, anti-intellectual, and profoundly lacking in empathy and self-awareness. He was something of an embodiment of the national character. Among the many things Kingsley Amis despised was the notion that a writer might regard himself as an artist. So Martin Amis arrived on the literary scene, preternaturally aware of who he was and where he stood. Amis, the younger, had to shout to be heard. His discovery of the other, of that which was not himself and his literary heritage, was therefore especially charged, and the habits of caricature and satire, along with the high degree of authorial self-consciousness that flowed from this discovery, came to define his writing. Martin Amis both suffered from the curse of Englishness and became its archest commentator. In 1989, a little flurry of scandal gave some edge to the Booker Prize proceedings. The two women on the jury threatened to resign if Martin Amis' London Fields, which their male counterparts wished to shortlist, were included. Their reason, at least according to the prize's chair, was Nicholas Six, the novel's central female character. The judges found her portrayal unfeminist, in other words, offensive to women. Better, badder, and harder than any man, Nicholas Six might almost in fact pass for a comic book feminist hero. Yet her unbreachable superiority to men is a superiority formulated according to male sexual and intellectual values. It is also her superiority, by the same values, to all women. It was this, presumably, that the judges found to be unfeminist. Still, A truly feminist act might have been to award the Booker Prize to a woman. The overlooked genius, Sybil Bedford, was on the short list, but London Fields was indeed excluded. In its day, the novel did not in fact seem to reflect a number of contemporary concerns, politics, regionalism, the search for equality and social justice, or to address historical realities. With its energy and length and noise, it was, if anything, an American novel. But an American novel that stubbornly concerned itself with something that most English novelists carefully avoided, the no-fly zone of social class in contemporary Britain. This Britain was undergoing a violent phase of evolution. The years of Thatcherism both exposed class divisions and inflamed them. Money and the scramble for it also created a new kind of equality, the equality of opportunism. These were the years in which capitalism shed its pitiless light on the absurd British soul, with its deep striations of caste and station, its post-colonial taint, most of all, its perverted emotional core, full of love and loathing for its own extremes of domination and servitude. Who then were Martin Amis' readers, the readers to whom, in 1989, his novel addressed itself? I myself, age 22, was certainly not among them. To me, it was clear that Martin Amis wrote for men, or, more accurately, for boys. His humor I understood to be puerile, full of the kind of gratuitous line crossing that young, educated males, insecure in their masculinity, reveled in. That he was the child of Kingsley Amis merely reinforced that impression. He was the perennial son, the enfant terrible, with the emphasis on enfant. His aura of paternal domination may indeed have constituted some of his allure. The boys I knew referred to him affectionately as Martin, or even, a nickname I feel sure he would have appreciated, Martole. When I was a little older, money and the information, and found myself becoming more interested. Whether or not I cared much about their content, the openness, the shamelessness of these books was striking. There was also the question of style, of the effort to entertain, a characteristic of the American novel of that period that its English equivalent largely lacked. The spirit of transgression that runs throughout Amis' work seemed continually to hearken to that which lay outside English literature's parameters. This transgression was not, importantly, intellectual. It was more a kind of naughtiness, a daredevil showing off that either thrilled or infuriated its onlookers, who could only wonder what kind of trouble the perpetrator would get into. Whatever else Amis' writing did, it woke people up to themselves, to their secret pruderies or prejudices, to their cultural conservatism. Amis treated imagination not as a refuge from reality, but as a maniacal enlargement of it. And if in doing so, he also inadvertently enlarged himself, the brazen tone of his novels suggested that he didn't care. In The Black Cross Pub, the novel's narrator, a failed and terminally ill American writer called Samson Young, mingles with his protagonists, Keith Tallant, Guy Clinch, and Nicola Six. Like Dickens, Martin Amis' character names are a clear signifier of parody. These are types, human representations of current social phenomena, with Keith and Guy, the aspirational thug and the idiotic aristocrat, as the pivotal pairing in Amis' portrayal of a nation and its masculinity in comic decline. Their interdependence and mutual miscomprehension is an illustration of the deep roots of British class perception, a mode of ordering the world whose concealment beneath the junk of modernity belies its extraordinary tenacity. These men, in other words, don't know why they act the way they do. Class never bothered Keith. He never thought about it as such. Part of a bygone era, whatever that was, class never worried him. It would surprise Keith a lot if you told him it was class that poisoned his every waking moment. Guy, like many a doomed aristocrat before him, mistakes Keith's brutishness for a simpler, more honest masculinity. With his sexually crippling romanticism, he misreads this new alliance for an entry into a greater truth. The women standing behind these men, the ghostly, tragic Kath Tallant and the factual Hope Clinch, have far greater contact with reality, yet far less capacity to determine its outcomes. The reason is their duty of motherhood, and one of the unusual facets of London Fields is the weight it attributes to babies, to their power of limitation and disturbance, most of all to their power of innocence. Even the wealthy mother, Hope Clinch, cannot control the monstrous possibilities of birth. The intelligent mother, Kath Tallant, is broken in her turn by the self-sacrifice required for the preservation of innocence. In Nicholas VI, Ami imagines a woman free of these constraints, her power of sexuality intact. Her contempt for men progressively honed by her independence from them. The fact that this woman can retain no interest in living, that as the author of her own story, she has no alternative but to arrange her own death, lies at the ambiguous core of London Fields. Ami's rendering of the world of the Black Cross is one of the novel's achievements. Steeped over time in the rancid deposits of male habit, the traditional British pub is rarely so accurately described. In the fog of cigarette smoke, the rituals of maleness are blearily, incoherently performed, their basis in evolution long since lost from view. Broader social changes, multiculturalism, the speed of technology, are diffidently incorporated into the mulch. Slow processes of decomposition and fermentation have replaced the line of history. In the pub, the one discernible truth remains the truth of gender. What men have in common is women. The pub is first and foremost a refuge from women, occasionally a place to display them, more often a scene of affirmation in the business of subduing them. Ami's intentions with Nicholas VI are harder to read, since she is one of the few figures in the book whose caricature isn't meant to produce laughter. He insists that she fully uses and exploits her femininity, yet the degree of pleasure this offers her is unclear. She's clever, cultivated, beautiful, hard-drinking, sexually predatory, and her one weakness, as she sees it, is a penchant for sodomy. The most important thing about her, in the milieu of London Fields, is that she is not a victim. It is she who has victims, who outplays the struggles of men. But to what end? Nicola was amazed by how few women really understood about underwear. It was a scandal. If the effortless enslavement of men was the idea, or one of the ideas, and who had a better idea, why have your chances by something as trivial as a poor shopping decision? In her travels, Nicola had often sat in shared bedrooms and cabins and boudoirs and powder parlors and watched debutantes, predatory divorcees, young hostesses, even reasonably successful good-time girls shimmying out of their cocktail dresses and ball gowns to reveal some bunched nightmare of bloomers, tights, long johns, Y-fronts, to ephemeral flatmates and sexual wallflowers at house parties, and to other under-equipped rivals. Nicola had sometimes carelessly slipped the underwear knowledge. It took about 10 seconds. 6 months later, the ones that got it right would be living in their own muse houses in Pimlico and looking 15 years younger. Nicola's ennui, her wanting out from life, is supposedly the consequence of all this strategic knowledge. It's too easy. It makes life no fun. Her interest in Keith lies in her conviction that he, in his stupidity and violence, will be the man to murder her. Ami tries to forestall the criticism that Nicola is merely the stuff of male fantasy by making Samson Young, his narrator, immune to her attractiveness. Samson isn't just terminally ill. He lives in a different register of love and longing. He isn't afflicted by the curse of Englishness, with its inflexible binaries, its violent categorizations of humans, its shaping even of their most secret and shameful desires. If Nicholas Six is a fantasy, in other words, she is a culturally determined one. The woman Samson Young pines for is an unyielding executive at a corporate American publishing house whose soft emotional center he once briefly glimpsed. The politics that made London Fields possible have changed, but not that much. Amis' caricatures retain their links to British reality. His observations about class, gender, and money still find their mark. One significant change from the tabloid-era London that is the novel's setting is the evolution of contemporary media and the explosion of social information it brought about. If anything, the present-day equivalents of Amis' types are more familiar to us than they would have been to the novel's first readers. We see and hear them all the time on our screens. Amis eventually left the United Kingdom, found other subjects, perhaps to try to free himself from the maddening obligation his bristling sensibilities toward the English put him under. One wonders what kind of writer, what kind of poet even, he would have been had he been born elsewhere. Thanks so much for joining me today for this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's articles have been from the March 2025 issue. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and looking forward to reading with you again next time.